welcome to Overtime Hockey Talk. My name is Mark Paul. Justin not joining me for today's episode since I have Steve Currier, author and historian. He wrote the book called The California Golden Seals, a defunct NHL franchise. I'm really excited to have him on the show talking about just that, the California Golden Seals. So welcome in Steve Currier. All right, we welcome in Steve Currier from GoldenSealsHockey.com. He's the author of The California Golden Seals, a tale of white skates, red ink, and one of the NHL's most outlandish teams. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw, actually, the way that I found you was on Reddit. I saw that you were doing an Ask Me Anything, an AMA, and I read through it and I was thinking, we got to have this guy on the show. This is such a unique topic, and our listeners, they have, you know, they've told me before that they love the history of hockey. Some of our most listened to episodes are about the all-time greatest players, and we went back into the different eras of hockey and went through all different positions, and those are stuff that a lot of people have given us great feedback about. And so I thought, what better to talk about than an old defunct franchise that I really knew nothing about. You sent me a book, and I've been able to read through some of that. But I'm looking forward to hearing the story from you. I know we talked about it a little bit before, but can you just tell our listeners how you got into, how did this start, you wanting to write a book about the California Golden Seals?
There's a lot of reasons why I want to write this book. I think it was just the Seals were just a very fascinating team for me as a kid. I was born in 79, so I was actually born a year after the team folded. We'll get to that later on and how that actually happened. But so I never actually saw them play. I just, as I was growing up and getting more interested in hockey books and hockey cards, I would run into pictures of the Seals, and their uniforms were always very interesting. I thought they changed so many times over the years. It seems like every year there's a different uniform, but it was a very interesting look, and I think that's kind of one thing that got the ball rolling as well, is the visual aspect of the team as well. I also remember in the 70s, there was a set of hockey cards. I think it was the 77-78 OPC set. And they had little team cards, just a white card with a logo on it. And on the back, it had like all the franchise records. And the one for the Cleveland Barons, which is, of course, what the Seals became, you look at the records, and it was all these names I'd never heard of before. The records weren't really very good compared to the teams like the Montreal Canadiens and the Boston Bruins. And it was all little things like that that just kind of got the ball rolling. But also seeing just little mentions of them in magazines and sticker books, and there was nothing in great detail anywhere at the time, and this is before the internet, of course, so to actually find information on the Seals at the time, you really had to go dig deep, and there weren't a lot of books on the subject or anything at all, so just little bits and pieces here and there. And I think as time went on and more information became available, it kind of got the ball rolling. And another thing that really helped to get the book started, I guess you could say, was whenever I was about 12 or so, and I'd written to the NHL and asked them about information on all the defunct franchises. I mean, like the Atlanta Flames, the Kansas City Scouts, and the Colorado Rockies, and all the others. And I don't know what I was expecting to send back. I mean, I just asked them for a list of records and things like that, and they probably didn't have time to answer my questions. So someone probably was just like, well, what can we do to satisfy this kid? They just photocopied the 75-76 Seals media guide, and they sent that to me, which turned out to be a wonderful idea, because I still have it to this day. It's probably the greatest piece of mail I've ever received. I read it cover to cover, and I just became really interested with the names that I'd never heard of. You know, these people like Norm Ferguson and Dave Hrecacy and Ted Hampson and Bill Hickey. These are players I had no idea who they were, but they really grew on me after a while, and I want to find out more and more about them. I guess just my natural curiosity as a kid. I always liked to research hockey and read up on it. So all those elements were really what got me started. And then I don't even know when I actually got the idea to start writing the book. I think I was in high school somewhere when I started just kind of putting information together. But once the internet really came about, I was able to get more articles and connect with people, the book really took shape around that point, I would say.
So this book is how many years in the making?
If you want to, I would say the very, very earliest draft, I would have been probably about 13 or so.
Really? And you're born in 79.
Again, so. I still have it upstairs at home. And just a very, very quick, 10 or 15 page book, but that would have been the first draft of it. And whenever I was in high school, maybe when I was about 16 or 17, I actually got down to brass tacks and I actually started writing down these long chapters and doing actual research at the library on microfilm and getting as many articles I could find. So the book that you have in your hands right now, I would say probably was about maybe 16 or 17 when I really started to write it.
I mean, so you're talking 20 years in the making, this book. This is, and I mean, I'm holding this book in my hand right now. This is not a small book. It's a good, very, very well researched. But it doesn't read like a research book at all. From the different parts that I've read in the book, it reads very much like the story of this crazy franchise that was, seemed all over the country, really went from California to Ohio. Let's actually dive in a little bit to tell the story of what happened here. I know that the first chapter in your book starts off actually long before the 67 expansion and really right around when the actual NHL formed in 1917. A couple minute synopsis, what brought about the San Francisco Seals originally and then the California Seals? There was no team west of west of Chicago before the expansion, right? And
yeah.
So what brought about a team all the way in California in 1967?
Well, the San Francisco Seals were a member of the Western Hockey League. Now, there's a Western Hockey League today, which is a junior league, but this is the Western Hockey League, the minor pro league. They were around, I think they started in the 1940s or 50s under different names, but the Western Hockey League decided to expand to California in 61. And they wanted a team in San Francisco and a team in Los Angeles. And so they founded the Seals and the Los Angeles Blades. And it was really at that point, there have been some previous hockey teams that have been in the Bay Area. There was a California Hockey League in the 1930s. None of these were very successful. None of them were very high minor leagues. They were pretty minor pro. But in 1961, the Western League, which had a very, very good collection of players. A lot of these guys had NHL experience or were about to go to the NHL. So this was a very, very high quality hockey league. And the San Francisco Seals from the first year were very competitive and the fan support they had was surprisingly strong. They were the first season, they were averaging about 5,000 or 5,500 per game. And over time, they were one of the more successful teams. They won the Western League Championship in 63 and in 64. And the city of San Francisco just adored their team. There was a really strong fan base in the Bay Area, especially on the San Francisco side. So around this time, the Seals were doing very well in the Western League. But the Western League was beginning to think about becoming a second professional league like the NHL. This is before the World Hockey Association came in, but the Western League was thinking about going pro. And in order to counter this threat of going pro, the National Hockey League decided that they were going to try to put teams in San Francisco and Los Angeles as well, and also in Minnesota and Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and in St. Louis. So the NHL was trying to put a few teams in the West as well to counter the Western Hockey League threat. And in the end, it worked. The NHL put their teams where they were planning on. The Western Hockey League ended up dying in 1974, and losing San Francisco and Los Angeles didn't help as well. How the Seals actually got into the NHL, they were bought by a man named Barry Van Gerbig and a group of some 40 or 50 investors. So they bought the Seals in, I believe it was 1965 or 66, if I remember correctly. And they bought the minor league Seals, and that was the team that they were going to take into the NHL. So when they went to the NHL in 1967, the newly christened California Seals had a good base already. They had all the Western League players that they had under contract. They just took them to the NHL as well. So they had a good base of players to begin with, even before the expansion draft even happened. And it was believed that the Seals were going to be a huge success in the new West division in the NHL, because they already had a minor league team built for them, plus the expansion draft. So it seemed like this was going to be a great success.
It sounds like they had a good, like what they thought would be a great minor league system to kind of funnel players into the NHL after that, right?
Yeah, they had a bunch of players. Like they had Jerry Odrowski, Tom Thurlby, Ron Harris, Charlie Burns, George Swarbrick. These were players that were with the Seals in the Western League and ended up playing with the Seals in their first year in the NHL. Most of the expansion teams had to go out and get themselves a minor league team, an affiliation. But the Seals already had these players. They just kind of brought them with them to the NHL, plus players in the expansion draft. So they had a good base of players. It seemed like they were going to have a lot of depth. They were even able to plan out a little bit more before the other teams, because they already had some players to start off with. But one of the reasons why the team failed that first season, if you go back to their last season in the Western League in 66-67, Barry Van Gerbig and his investors decided that San Francisco wasn't going to be an appropriate enough place to put an NHL team. The Cal Palace, where they played, was not an NHL caliber rink. It was a bit small. It smelled like cows because they had rodeos and they had cattle auctions and things like that going on. So it had very, very poor sight lines. It was an awkward building, even though the atmosphere was great. So they ended up moving the Seals to Oakland, where they were going to be building a brand new rink that was going to be able to house a hockey team and also basketball and football. So this is what the main mistake was moving the team from San Francisco, where they had a good fan base, to Oakland, where they had almost no fan base, but they had a nice arena. This is one of the reasons why it failed. Oakland never really took to the Seals, and San Francisco fans never really wanted to drive all the way to Oakland to watch a game. I was told, whenever I spoke to several people, players and people that were in the organization, they said that in the Bay Area, there's a sort of a psychological barrier between San Francisco and Oakland. If you live in Oakland, you don't go to San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco, you don't go to Oakland for anything. San Francisco is very, they say it's a bit maybe pseudo-sophisticated. It's a bit high class. Oakland's very blue collar. And so it's two very, very different cities, two very different crowds. And when they moved the team to Oakland, they believed that the San Francisco fans were just going to drive over to Oakland and everything would just continue the way it is. But in the end, San Francisco fans didn't want to go to Oakland. And that was one of the reasons why the team ended up having the worst attendance in the league the first year and every other year in the league afterwards. They just couldn't get fans from all over the Bay Area to come watch the games in Oakland.
They did not do their market research.
Yeah, they thought they did, but they should have kept the team in Oakland and San Francisco. But the NHL wasn't keen on having the Cal Palace be their rink. But the NHL absolutely wanted to have a team in the Bay Area. That was one of the stipulations of the CBS TV contract: a team in Oakland or in the Bay Area, and a team in Los Angeles. And so Oakland had the rink, so that was the best solution. They put the team there. They figured it wouldn't make a big difference. People would go to the games anyway, but turns out that moving the team to Oakland was one of the worst mistakes they could have made. It also didn't help much that they changed the team name from San Francisco Seals to California Seals in their last Western League season, and they kept that name going into the NHL. Well, the people in San Francisco were a little bit insulted because they took the San Francisco name away from the team, put California in there instead, and before the first NHL season was even done, they ended up changing the team name again to the Oakland Seals. So again, people in San Francisco didn't really have much interest in going to a team that that didn't really represent them at all. It had the Oakland name. It's almost like if you're a San Francisco, if you're living in San Francisco, you're not going to go support the Oakland A's. You're going to support the San Francisco Giants, most likely.
Right.
So this is another one of the problems they had in that first season. And the fans of San Francisco just never ended up really taking to the team afterwards, at least not in large numbers.
Yeah, and it sounds like there was a lot of ownership changes throughout the years too for them, which it sounds like the problem was continuity in any way. They've changed their name three times before the end of the first season, right? Between the year before and that next year. And they I know Labatt Brewery tried to buy this team and move them to Vancouver. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so before the season, first season was a total disaster. They weren't winning on the ice. No one was coming to the games. They were averaging about 4,500 a game in a 12,000-seat rink. So even in a small rink, they couldn't even fill it. And so Labatt Breweries were hoping to buy the Seals and move them to Vancouver. And so, which would have been a great idea. Of course, Vancouver has had a team for over 40 years, and they've been a great success. But the NHL had absolutely no interest in putting a team in Vancouver for two reasons. One, it looked really embarrassing to move a team after just 1 year. And this is their big expansion plan. They were doubling in size. This was a huge event for the NHL. It would have been very embarrassing to move a team to Vancouver after just 1 year. And the other reason why they didn't want to put a team in Vancouver is because Vancouver was seen as a very a good site for a next expansion team, which they ultimately did in 1970. Vancouver was rejected in 67, but they were still on the list of teams, potential teams, potential cities for an expansion team. So moving the Seals to Vancouver, the NHL would have lost out on $6 million. And as we saw throughout the 1970s, with all the frequent expanding that they were doing, that was one of the main reasons. It was, you know, every time they would expand, it would be $6 million to the league. And in later years, it would be more. So they didn't really have an interest in moving the team for that reason, because there was a nice windfall that they were going to be losing out on.
Right. So their first season, they sucked. They were 15-42-17. But their second season, they found success, right? They changed ownerships and things started going better.
Yeah, the team really reconstructed itself. So Bert Olmsted was the coach that first year. He didn't work out. He didn't get along well with the players. He was very demanding, and he would have these excruciating practices where players would be just doing stops and starts for seemingly endless amount of time. And they'd be throwing up over the sides of the boards, and he was trying to push them to play his way of hockey. When he was a player, he was very gritty and very tough. All the Seals players didn't have his talent, or they didn't have his grit. So he got very frustrated, and he quit before the end of the first season. And before the second season, Bert Olmsted was replaced as general manager and coach. Frank Selke Jr. became the general manager. Fred Glover became the coach, and Bill Torrey was also brought in as the executive vice president. So the three of them really set about changing the team attitude, team atmosphere. They brought in players from the American League. They brought in Norm Ferguson, for example, who ended up having 34 goals his first year. They ended up making a couple of trades. They traded Bobby Bond to Detroit. They brought in Gary Jarrett, who brought in a bit more offense. And they drafted Carol Vadney in the interleague draft from Montreal. So he brought a little bit of offense to the blue line. a bit of star power as well. So these players they brought in, and they also kept the best player from the first year. Ted Hampson was retained, so was Bill Hickey and Jerry Eamon and Charlie Hodge and Gary Smith. So they had a good base, and with these new players they brought in, there was just a complete turnover. The team all of a sudden was able to score goals, and they were much more competitive. They finished second in the West Division because they were, they had some depth finally, and they had some good quality NHL players. And unfortunately, it didn't really remain that way. It seemed that every player that season hit their peak. They all had their best seasons at the same time, and you know when that happens in any kind of sport, when everyone peaks, eventually the next year, 2 years down the road, you know, not everyone's going to stay at that, play that peak performance year after year, and eventually cracks are going to show, and then the team's going to fall apart, which is what happened.
Sure, and finishing so poorly the year before, I'm sure that maybe a lot of teams thought they would just walk in there and roll on them, so teams aren't necessarily bringing their A game against you every night, but then all of a sudden, hey, you finish second in your division, this team's good now, we need to bring it, and that's also what can happen, is, you know, teams are ready for you the next year, and maybe the year before was a little bit of a fool's gold.
Yeah, and the first year as well, and another thing that's very strange is how badly they finished is that the first year Seals, most of their games were played against the other expansion teams. They played, I think, 50 of their 74 games against the other expansion teams, and they couldn't beat them, let alone the original six teams. The second year, they played more games against the original six teams and ended up having a better record overall. So you really could see the improvement of the team from year to year two. It's very strange how the Seals finished so poorly, considering they played most of their games against the other expansion teams who drafted from the same pool. They had the same level of talent. They really weren't that much better on paper. But yet, when they played the Seals, it seems like they always came out on top, and the Seals were always ending up in adding another one to the loss column.
Yeah. Well, okay, so they make the playoffs, right, that year, but they lost to the Kings, right, in that first round?
Yeah.
I had no idea that there was a battle of the two California teams in only their second year. It sounds like that was basically the peak for this team, right? Over the course of the next 8 years, they don't go that far into the playoffs where they how many games did they win? It was a 7-game series?
Yeah, it went 7 games, and it was I believe, if I remember correctly, they actually had the series lead. They were up 3-2, and they just need one more win to go to the next round, but they ended up losing the last 2 games to Los Angeles. And you're right when you say that really was their peak. The year after, they made the playoffs again by the skin of their teeth. They had the same amount of points as Philadelphia and tied for fourth place, but they got in because the Seals had a few extra wins, and they got smoked in 4 games against Pittsburgh. So really the peak was that 68-69 season, and in the playoffs. They never really got back to that level again afterwards.
Okay, and so they lose to the Penguins in the first round of the playoffs. I think Chapter 5 to me is one of the most interesting and entertaining chapters in this book, just because of they get sold again, and there's some pretty crazy promotional things going on. Talk to us about some of those.
So Chapter 5, I believe, is the 70-71 season when Charlie Finley bought the team. Charlie Finley was, of course, he dabbled in just every one of the major sports. He, of course, he's most famous as the owner of the Kansas City Athletics, and which later became the Oakland Athletics. He's famous for putting almost all of his players in any team, in any sport. He had them wear green and gold and white uniforms. He was known for crazy gimmicks and crazy promotions in baseball, and that carried over into hockey as well. So Finley believed that these like circus stunts would get fans into the building. So on opening night in 70-71, he had live seals come out onto the ice. He thought it'd be great to have a seal as a mascot. Well, the seal just ended up laying on the ice. I mean, seals tend to like ice, so that's what he did. He just laid there and didn't do anything. So the mascot didn't last very long. He also thought it would be a great idea. It's like, well, the players are wearing yellow and green uniforms. Why not try that with the skates as well? So the team was decked in head-to-toe yellow and green, including the skates. A couple other teams thought it was a decent idea, and a few other teams actually had colored skates as well for a year or two. But then the only reason why he went the yellow and gold skates as well is because he was told that, well, the white skates that you want to use, that's just not going to happen. Like these kangaroo skin skates that he was thinking about, it's just not going to happen. It's not going to work. The skate has to be solid. Kangaroo skin is not going to do it. So he put that idea on the back burner, and then the year after, he revisited the white skate idea, and these skates were completely, the first year, completely covered in white. One of the boys, my interview for the book, he told me to take out to paint these skates. And the problem with white skates is that the pucks are going to hit the skates, and the black tape on sticks is going to hit the skates. They're going to get scuffed when the players fall down. So to keep those skates looking pristine and white, you have to paint those after almost every game.
Oh, God.
And the players, and I'm not sure if they meant this as a joke or if it was actually serious, but they would say that the skates would actually get heavier as the games would go because you keep painting something.
You got more and more layers.
And you're just adding more weight to it. And so it, and the thing that I wish I'd looked more into it, and I just kind of thought about it afterwards after the book was published, but the white skates came in around January of 72. The Seals were playing pretty well that year. They had a first year with Finley that was terrible. The second year, they were playing very well. And around January, Finley decides this is the time to bring in the white skates once again. The players had practiced with them a little bit, and he said, okay, now bring those skates out. So he gives the players the skates, and they start wearing them. And the first few games, they did all right with them. And all of a sudden, the Seals stopped to win. They stopped winning after a little while. And I don't know if it's because the skates are getting too heavy and they just kind of like they had a hard time catching up with the other teams, literally. But you can definitely see at the end of the 71-72 season, the team really had an awful last month and a half. And you can wonder, is it because the skates were just too heavy that it affected their play? The players seem to think that the skates did get heavier and heavier as the season went on. So the white skates might have actually cost them the playoff spot in 1 year. It's kind of hard to say if it really happened or not, but it is interesting to think about.
Right. Yeah, Vili Leino must have gotten the idea for white skates from them. I remember that was Mike Babcock when he was in Detroit, and Vili Leino had his white skates. Babcock hated it because he just didn't like his white skates. So you said that – so the Seals had the opportunity to draft Guy Lafleur, and obviously they,
yes.
Obviously they did not. Who did they take over Guy Lafleur, and were you able to find out their reasoning behind their choice?
Well, a lot of the expansion teams in those first few years had a tendency of trading away their first-round draft picks for immediate help. And the draft at the time, you got to understand, is it wasn't really seen as being as important as it is now. Like, teams now will stockpile these draft picks, and they very rarely trade unless they get like a really good offer for it. Back then, the expansion teams were just hoping to have these warm bodies come in from the original six teams, you know, players that could that were maybe on the downside of their career that could maybe help out and score 20 goals or something. They weren't really thinking long term. And the first few years of the draft, there wasn't really a lot of players that that were super overhyped or anything like that. It wasn't like the big media machine that it is now. But by about 1971, there actually was a lot of hype around these draft picks. There was Marcel Dion and Guy Lafleur were available in that 71 draft, among a lot of other really great players. Now, the Seals, the year before, had decided, well, maybe what we can do with Montreal, we'll trade our first-round pick for your first-round pick, and we'll swap a couple players here and there. It's not a very big trade. It'll be fine. Well, it turns out that that pick they traded was the first overall pick in 71 because the Seals finished dead last that year, and the teams finished dead last would always get the first overall pick. So Montreal, who just won the Stanley Cup that year, ended up also getting the first round pick. They wanted Guy Lafleur so badly that they even traded Ralph Backstrom to Los Angeles to help the Kings move up ahead of the Seals in the standings, because they knew if the Seals finished last. They get the first overall pick. Well, it turns out trading Backstrom was a great idea because Backstrom had a bit of revival in Los Angeles. He had a great second half. The Kings ended up finishing a good 15 points ahead of the Seals, and the Seals ended up finishing last. So they would have gotten the first overall pick, but they had to give it up to Montreal.
Yeah, maybe some other teams need to implement that strategy. Think, all right, who can we trade this guy to so we get a better draft pick? That's pretty funny that they did that. Well, so let's move ahead. So the World Hockey Association, they come in and they end up leaving Oakland, right?
Yeah. So the World Hockey Association was probably the most damaging element to come around as far as the Seals are concerned. Now, Finley didn't really help matters too much either, but when the World Hockey Association came in, the timing couldn't have been worse. If the Seals had a bad team, it might not affect too much. But in 1971-72, the Seals had shown some major improvement in the standings. Like I was mentioning, they were in a playoff position most of the year, and it was only towards the last 6 weeks of the season or so when they started to fall apart and they missed the playoffs. But they had a really good nucleus of players. They had guys like Reggie Leach. They had Joey Johnson, Walt McKechnie, Gilles Meloche. They had Tom Webster, Wayne Carlton, and Jerry Pinder, and a bunch of other good, solid hockey players. No superstars, but they had a good team that had potential to get much better. But Finley, in his infinite wisdom, never liked paying his players what they were worth, whether that was in baseball or in hockey. And so these players who, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but the NHL contracts at the time, even if a player had signed a 5-year deal, he could take off anytime he wanted because the contracts, the way they were written out, they had to be renewed every year. So at the end of the season, the player was technically a free agent. They just stayed in the NHL. There was no other options anyway. But now the World Hockey Association came in, players started hearing from their lawyers and from the World Hockey Association that, no, these contracts you guys are signing are not worth the paper they're written on. Like, if you want to leave at the end of the season, you can leave, and there's nothing the NHL can do about it. Well, when the Seals players heard this and they realized the World Hockey Association was offering, you know, 2 and 3 times what Finley was going to offer, they took these deals and they went to the World Hockey Association. They were guaranteeing contracts. They were guaranteeing money. They were making 2 and 3 times what the NHL was going to offer them. So players like Wayne Carlton and Tom Webster and Jerry Pinder, who were seen as being the nucleus of their team, they all took off for these great deals. And the Seals, in the end, were just a shell. There was nothing left. There was a couple of good players, but there was no depth. Their minor league system, they were forced to call up all their best players to fill in these spots in the NHL. And so even the minor league team was terrible. They in Columbus, they 1 year they only won 10 games, and the next year they might have won 15 or something because there was no talent in the minors, and there wasn't enough talent in the NHL either. So it was a team that was just completely decimated by the World Hockey Association, and they never really recovered from that. It took them years, maybe 4 or 5 years, when they started getting on the right track again. And by this point, financially, they were just so they were such in ruins that there wasn't much they could do anymore.
So, at what point did they move to Cleveland?
So at the end of the 75-76 season, this was one of their better seasons. They were very, very good, actually. Again, they were challenging for a playoff spot most of the year, and attendance was starting to improve. They were up to about 6,900 per game at that point. So there was a bit of an upswing, and their new owner, Finley had sold the team to the NHL back in 74. The NHL sold the team to a man named Mel Swig, who was a San Francisco hotelier. And he was very respected in San Francisco. He had lots of connections, and he really loved hockey. He'd been an original owner of the Western Hockey Seals as well. So he was a good owner. He was just the right person to take over the team, and he had lots of plans for them. And one of his plans was to get the Seals a new arena in San Francisco and move them back to where they should have been in the first place. So he'd negotiated a deal with Joe Alioto, who was the mayor of San Francisco. And the Aliotos and the Swig family were very close. They had a great connection. Joe Alioto said, "Don't worry about it. You've got your arena deal. It's set. It's done. And that's where his Seals are going to be ending up in a couple of years. They're going to have a new rink, 18,000 seats in San Francisco. Well, timing is everything, as we all know. And before the start of the 76-77 season, Joe Aliotta was voted out of office and replaced by George Moscone. And Moscone and his council turned down the arena proposal. And so the Seals were basically left with two options, either to stay in Oakland, where they continued to lose money, or they could move. And that's what they decided to do. Now, Sweet had taken on a few co-owners during the year, George and Gordon Gund, who were from Cleveland. And so they gave him the idea of moving the team to Cleveland. They thought, well, Cleveland has a long hockey history, and guess what? Their World Hockey Association team has just folded. So there's a nice 18,000-seat rink in Richfield that's open for business, and we can put the Seals right in there. And so they thought it was a great idea, and they moved the Seals to Cleveland. Little did they know that the rink was 26 miles out of town and nowhere near Akron, nowhere near Cleveland. So they were having the same problem that the Cleveland Crusaders of the World Hockey Association were having. No one was going to the games because the rink was out in the middle of nowhere. And add to that, the fact that it's wintertime, very few people want to make a trek from, you know, Cleveland all the way down to the middle of nowhere to watch a hockey game, especially a team that wasn't really doing all that well in the standings. So Cleveland was a big mistake. Not that the city couldn't support a team, it's just that the rink was just in such a bad location that the team was set up to fail from day one.
Yeah, that's barely Cleveland, right? 26 miles outside of the city. Especially, and you're talking, this is 1975. So, I mean, I guess as time has gone on, we'll travel a little further. But, I mean, even now, you look at teams that exist where they're outside of the city that they're supposed to be in. You look at Arizona, a team like Ottawa, where they're off in Canada, they struggle to get people because they're too far outside of the actual city that they're supposed to be in. And it causes problems. It's funny that teams now, they don't look back at something like this and go, this has never worked. We shouldn't do this. But teams continue to do it. No, we'll build 30 miles outside of here. It'll be fine. And then it still remains a problem. So they moved to Cleveland, and would they last 2-3 years in Cleveland then?
So they played 2 years in Cleveland. The first year they barely survived that to begin with, because they realized pretty quickly that they were drawing flies at the Coliseum, the Richfield Coliseum, and they were losing money. They were just hemorrhaging money. At one point in January, they were this close to actually just folding the team and dispersing the players amongst the other NHL teams. And it was really the NHL Players Association that came in at the 11th hour. They loaned the Barons, the Cleveland Barons, I think it was about $350,000 just to get the team through the season, to pay because the players weren't even getting paid at this point. They were just sitting around and waiting to find out what was going to happen. So they weren't getting paid, and the NHLPA stepped in and they provided them with a little bit of extra money to get them through the season. But, you know, things weren't going all that well. At the end of the season, Mel Swig decides to sell his part of the team to the Gunn brothers, that became the sole owners. And in the last season in Cleveland, they were the sole owners of the team. They tried to put a little bit of money into the team. They tried to acquire some better players in midseason. They were even challenging for a playoff spot at one point. But after a while, again, if you're averaging 5,000 or 6,000 a game, it just wasn't enough. Like, the player salaries were going up and up because they're competing with the World Hockey Association. So eventually, after a while, they just couldn't compete anymore. And then they decided, what would be the best option for this team? We could just fold them, or we could perhaps we could merge them with another team. And that's the idea that ultimately stuck. The Minnesota North Stars were doing just as badly in the standings, and they weren't really doing it at all attendance-wise either. They were averaging maybe 8,000 or 9,000 a game compared to the 15 or 16 they were getting years before. So they were in bad shape as well and were on the verge of folding as well. So they decided, the owners of both franchises, they said, well, if we merge the two teams, we can keep the best players from both franchises, and then we'll continue with this new kind of super franchise, if you want to call it that, and the rest of the players would be dispersed amongst the other NHL teams, and that's what they did. And it turned out to be, it saved the Minnesota North Stars franchise as well, because they were doing very, very poorly. But when they got players like Des Maruk and Al McAdam and Jill Melosh, all of a sudden, and with the stars they already had in Minnesota, they turned out to have a pretty good team. They went to the Stanley Cup final in 81, and throughout the 80s, they had a pretty good team. They were competitive, and it was because of that merger that they managed to survive those extra years. They ended up moving to Dallas, of course, later on, but they wouldn't have made it to to the 1990s if it hadn't been for that merger.
So technically, if you want it, they merged. So they merged with the Minnesota North Stars. Minnesota North Stars become the Dallas Stars, and the Dallas Stars win the Cup in 1999. So technically,
yeah,
California Golden Seals were a part of that win. In some crazy connection.
Sort of way. It's like anything else the Seals did, it's in the most convoluted, difficult, complicated way possible. You could say they have a part of that Stanley Cup, but just trying to trace it back it takes forever to figure it out. But in the most technical senses, you could say, yeah, they do have that Stanley Cup finally. It's very difficult to trace that lineage back to the very, very beginning.
Yeah, and then I like the way that you ended your book talking about the San Jose Sharks, obviously a team in the Bay Area. What kind of influence were you able to find that the Golden Seals had on the Sharks getting a team?
So the Sharks, in a way, so this is what's really strange about the Seals, is that you can trace their lineage back to two different teams, Dallas and San Jose. Now, I mentioned the merger that happened in 78 when they took Cleveland and Minnesota. They made one team out of it, and they continued as the Minnesota North Stars. When, during the late 80s, the Gunn brothers were kind of getting sick and tired of being in Minnesota, they all of a sudden wanted to put a team back in the Bay Area in San Jose. And the NHL wanted to put an expansion team there. Now, again, like I mentioned before, the NHL would prefer to put a new team in a certain market because you have those expansion fees, which at the time I think was about $50 million for a team. So the NHL didn't really want to move Minnesota to San Jose because they'd lose out on this great market and $50 million. So the NHL decided that they would let the Gunn brothers keep the San Jose expansion franchise if they sold the North Stars to someone else, which is what they did. And as part of their deal, they sort of, it was a bit of a demerger where they split the team back into two. So if you look at on Wikipedia or something, and you look at the San Jose Sharks expansion draft picks, you'll notice a lot of them come from Minnesota. And that's what it was. The Sharks were allowed to pick a certain number of players from the Minnesota North Stars roster. So they had a pretty sweet deal when they came into the NHL. They were able to pick these extra players, plus they got to participate in the expansion draft as well. And the North Stars also participated in the expansion draft to pick up those players they lost. So the merger started in 1978. It lasted until 1991, I believe it was. And then they split the teams back up again.
That's awesome. So there's... Yeah, so that all those franchises connected together because of the Golden Seals, very, very cool. And there's a booster club that still meets. Is that correct? They still meet for like Golden Seals.
Oh yeah, they still do. Yeah,
really?
It's getting smaller and smaller, but it's they still meet. I think on a monthly basis, maybe a bi-monthly basis now. But they're definitely getting much older. There's a lot of them that are in their 80s and they're. There's a lady that I interviewed for the book. Her name is Kathy White. And surprisingly enough, she actually lives in Ottawa, which I was shocked when I found out that she was 5 minutes away from my office.
That's convenient.
So I went and talked to her. And she's, I think she's 94 years old now and still a huge, huge Seal fan. And the boosters that are still in San Francisco, they still meet regularly at Ricky's Sports Bar, I think it's called. And they send out a newsletter every month, and I'm part of the booster club myself. I'm the only one I think that's under the age of 40, and I'm the only one that lives in Canada right now, as far as I know. And Yeah, it's a close place. Regularly, they meet up. They wear their Seals t-shirts and jerseys, and they just chit chat about the good old days. And it's more of a social gathering now than anything else. But they organize little trips to the NHL Booster Club convention sometimes, and they often make little trips and things like that to go watch games in San Jose and even minor league hockey and things like that. So it's remarkable that they've actually survived this long. Like, this franchise moved in 76, and here we are, 50 years later, they're still thriving and they're still continuing. There's only about 30 members or so left, but the fact that they're still together is really quite remarkable. And it shows that the fans in the Bay Area, they had some very, very dedicated fans. They just didn't have enough of them. That was the problem. But there's some really diehard fans down there. You look at San Jose, the Sharks, how well they're doing, and it's really not that surprising to me that the team has done well attendance-wise since the very, very first day. They've never had any money problems whatsoever because the roots were already there. Yep. Long before the Sharks even came in, and you can see the dedication of the fans today. We're still supporting the Seals, even.
My guess is that the Atlanta Thrashers don't still have a booster club, do they?
I'm not sure about that. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a couple that still their boosters still exist. I think the Atlanta Flames still have one.
Really? Oh, okay.
I'm pretty sure the NHL booster club. In the Booster Club convention, you can see the different teams represented. I think I've seen the Atlanta Flames in there. It's really remarkable sometimes that these clubs have managed to exist this long.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, hey, one more question before I let you go. I'm sure that you know if this topic comes up, is there a story, one particular thing that you just latch onto, or a funny moment in trying to research this that's your favorite story throughout this franchise's history?
There's so many different stories. Like there's two that I really like. There's the story of Pete LaFrampois, who was a high Seals draft pick, and he never really had a very long career, but one night he actually scored four goals, and the Seals ended up winning 11-3 against Vancouver. It's the only time they ever scored 10 goals in a game, and they just destroyed the Vancouver Canucks this night. But the backstory of this game was the day before they had a practice, and many of the Seals players were late. They just forgot the practice was going to be at that time, or they showed up late because they were nonchalant or something. So Fred Glover, the coach, he was very upset. And then at the end of the practice, he points at the clock and he tells them, you know, there's going to be practice again tomorrow at this time. And he bangs a stick on the ice and he takes off. Well, the next night, the Seals went on the 1-11-3. So they were, and in the newspaper, they were saying that the Seals might be extra motivated this night. Well, it turns out, yeah, they scored 11 goals. They were very motivated. Pete LaFrambois had four of his own, and that was still a team record. So that was an interesting night. And Charlie Finley, who almost never came to the games, he was a very absentee owner. He cared about his baseball team. He didn't really care much about the Seals. Why he owned them, who knows. But he was actually there in attendance. The one game he shows up, they score 11 goals. And according to Joe Starkey, who was the play-by-play man, Charlie Finley was sitting right in front of him, just below him, and he said Finley couldn't have cared less. He wasn't paying any attention to the game whatsoever, which just sort of goes to show that it just was a bad fit. So that's one story that I thought was really interesting. The other one, if I can mention this one, it's been told quite a few times, I think, but it's a good story. The Washington Capitals, in their first NHL season, this is 1974-75, they hadn't won a road game all season long. So this is nearing the end of the season. This is from March. They've lost 37 games on the road in a row. They haven't tied a game. They haven't won a single game on the road. Well, they go into Oakland, and wouldn't you know it, of course, they beat the Seals. So the Capitals players, they go back to the dressing room. They're all excited. They've won their first and only road game of the year. One of the players, I believe it was Tommy Williams, who was a former SEAL, he picks up this green garbage can and he hoists it up over his head like the Stanley Cup, and they passed it around to all the players, and they went back out onto the Coliseum ice when everyone was gone, and they paraded this garbage can around like it was the Stanley Cup. This was their big moment. They won 8 games all year. They won 1 on the road, and that was their Stanley Cup. And so all the players on Capitals, they all ended up signing this green garbage can. And the following year, one of the players had told me, again, a player from the Washington Capitals, he said that the next year when they came back to the Coliseum, that garbage can with all their signatures on it was still there in the dressing room. So I don't know what happened to that garbage that's can, awesome. But if anyone ever has it with a bunch of strange-looking signatures on it, that's the Stanley Cup garbage can that the Washington Capitals paraded around the Coliseum.
that's pretty incredible. I think I just looked it up because I remembered that that Capitals team is the worst season any team's ever had, and they allowed 446 goals in 80 games.
Yep.
But yeah, that was.
They beat the Seals.
They beat the Seals on the road. There you go. Well, hey Steve, I really appreciate you coming on the show and just sharing us that story of the California Golden Seals. You want to just take a second and just let everybody know where they can find your book?
Yeah, so there's lots of different options. You go on the University of Nebraska website. They have a link there where you can purchase the book. It's also available on Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, probably a few other websites as well, but I know for sure those two websites are selling the book. And you can also check out my website, GoldenSealsHockey.com. There's some links on the site as well to where you can purchase the book, but also there's some check synopsis and just little things to let you know about the Seals and their history if you want to read up on it before you actually go and buy the book. There's lots of information on the site that and little stories and anecdotes that people might enjoy to read over.
Perfect. Yeah, I just got you sent me my copy in the mail yesterday, and I'm looking forward to really diving in and reading through it. We'll have all those links in the show notes, and so you can just click on that. You can get the book and go check out his website as well. Steve, appreciate you coming on, and we'll hope to, if you write another book, we'd love to have you on and talk about that as well.
Well, thanks. It was great to be on. Had a lot of fun.
All right, so did we. Thanks for joining us today on Overtime Hockey Talk. You can find us on Twitter at OT Hockey Talk, or go to our website at OTHockeyTalk.com for more hockey insight. Our next episode will be coming out momentarily. And by momentarily, I mean tomorrow. If you want to find Steve's book or his website, GoldenSealsHockey.com, all the links will be in the show notes. Have a great rest of your day.